I took the glass that Uncle Mike poured and brought it to my lips, and stopped. I set it down on the table with a shaky hand, gave Uncle Mike a tight smile. I had a bad experience with drink in the Fae. His eyes grew sad.
I'd forgotten that.
He touched the glass, and the liquid cleared.
It's water now, cool and sweet. I give you my word that water is all it is, safe for you to drink. But if you'd rather not, I will not take offense.
I took a sip, and it tasted like water. Garou glanced at Beauclair, who shook his head. Neither of them had heard that story. They could get the whole tale from Uncle Mike when we were gone. I mostly trusted Uncle Mike. But as soon as no one was paying attention to me, I set the water down on the table and left it there. So, I said as the others drank their cider, when we left off, the Fae were stuck between a rock and a hard place. Let me guess, the result of the discussion that Uncle Mike is so gleeful about was the release of a few of the nasties that the Grey Lords have been keeping a chokehold on. We had a little excitement, and some werewolf friends of mine had trouble in Arizona. I let them see what I thought about their solution. The two that I knew about both preyed upon children.
I was unhappy with the decision, Beauclair said. I was unhappier with the way it was carried out. The Fae who were released were all under a death sentence. After they had caused a stir, one of us was supposed to go out and kill them, making us heroes of sorts.
I gave him a sour look. The years I had spent working with Z had given me more than the know-how to rebuild an engine. I had Z's patented sour look down cold. That's not what happened.
No, agreed Beauclair.
Maybe he'd hung out with Z at some point, too, because his sour look was pretty good.
I thought it was overly optimistic. I was outvoted.
He gave Garou a cool look. Garou grimaced.
I had no choice. We need someone in with the genocidal bunch. Since I'm the one with a harmless look and no reputation for stuff, it's got to be me. We vote as a block.
The genocidal bunch? I asked cautiously. He nodded.
The majority of the Grey Lords want to deal with the humans from a point of strength. Appease us, and we won't kill you. But there is a cadre of us who look at Underhill, look at our numbers, and at the fact that our population has dropped by half since we left Europe and traveled here, and they don't believe we can survive. They want a war with the humans or a war with the werewolves that will devolve into a war with the humans. They think that if all of Faerie fight, we can kill humankind and die in glory.
I felt like someone had knocked the wind out of me.
Are they right?
Asked Adam.
Could you destroy humanity?
Garou shrugged.
I don't know. Maybe.
Uncle Mike took a deep drink of his cider and said,
The only thing that has saved us so far is that they are aware that most of the Fae, the ones who are not Grey Lords, would like to live. We don't care so much about the Fae as a race. We care about ourselves and our families. And there are still enough of us that we'd have a fair chance of stopping the Grey Lords who want war, which is why they have to make the humans, or failing that, the werewolves, make war first.
Did Bran know this? I took a deep breath. Of course he did. He'd abandoned our pact so that if we failed to negotiate with the Fae, they couldn't use that as the flashpoint for a war with all of the werewolves. Was it better that Bran abandoned us not just for the safety of the werewolves, but of the humans and probably the Fae, too? Yes. The Widow Queen is one of the suicidal, genocidal group, I hazarded. Garou shook his head.
No, she's part of her own small group of delusional idiots. She thinks that if the werewolves don't come in on the human side, we can actually kill all the humans who live on this continent and survive. Happily, you've just killed most of her followers. She thought she could use Aiden to gain control of Underhill as part of some further and complicated plot to destroy the other Grey Lords and take control. She likes to rule.
To be fair, Uncle Mike said, we watched the Europeans do a fair job of killing off the people who were originally on this continent.
He gave me a sly look.
You could ask your father's people about that. But she doesn't have smallpox or the black measles, so she's trying out a few other things. The last one was a troll who was nearly mindless. There are a few of them who are quite brilliant by troll standards, at least, Mercy.
but who had the delightful talent of growing in strength every time he ate a human, and in the water was impossible to kill. I stared at him, trying to imagine that troll being stronger. Uncle Mike gave me a cheery smile. Happily for our side, he was too dumb to jump in the water before your pack killed him. Had he made it to the city and started killing hundreds of people, none of us could have stopped him. He paused. Well, maybe Nemain or Beauclair. But the Widow Queen forgets how much power she's lost.
Our storytelling this night is at an end, Beauclair said softly. He got up from the table. If you would excuse me for a few moments, Garau will continue our conversation.
Garau leaned forward.
The situation with your pack has presented us with a unique opportunity. We need to negotiate with the human government, and have scared them to the point that there is no path for communication. But you killed a troll.
He let that statement sit in the air.
And you did it on national TV. In the past few months, several fairy monsters have been publicly taken down by werewolves.
He tapped on the table.
If we can manage to sign a non-aggression pact that would make the Tri-Cities a neutral territory, somewhere that we have agreed that no aggressive act can take place, enforced by someone the humans can trust in their honor and in their ability, then it is just possible that we might avoid a war with the humans and go back to how we have been. Coexisting.
Are we negotiating with Beauclair and Garau? Asked Adam softly. Or the Council of the Grey Lords?
The Council, Garau said. Beauclair to represent the majority and I the minority opinion. It took some doing for that to happen. If they'd been able to locate Orla, this would have been much more difficult.
Garau, I said, did you hurt Z? He met my eyes.
No.
So why did you cringe from him? He smiled.
Because it was the action that the male who I pretend to be would have done once the wristlets had proven him weaker than the half-dead daughter of one of the old kings. Such a fae would know that Z was a threat he could not face.
They believe that? Asked Adam. That a Grey Lord would be so weak?
They remember the old kings, Uncle Mike answered.
They remember what Z can do. They fear him themselves, and Garau is powerful enough that the battles he fought to become a Grey Lord looked like a political animal wiggling his way into power.
He smiled,
and most of them would have been afraid to share those wristlets with the daughter of the dragon under the hill.
All right, I said, and looked to Adam.
You know that we would sign a non-aggression pact, he said, so why the story hour?
Because nothing is that simple, agreed Garau. The humans might believe that your killing of the troll was enough to make us sign such an agreement, but those of Faerie know better. It would be a loss of face, and might spell the downfall of the Grey Lords. The individuals are strong, but there are those like your Z and Uncle Mike,
he nodded to Uncle Mike, who grinned and drank his cider,
who hide what they are. If we appear too weak, we shall be brought down, and chaos will rule. That would not be good for anyone. So, he stood up, two things. First, a show of force, something to demonstrate that it is no weakness of the Fae that makes us sign a treaty. Beauclair should be ready for his demonstration.
I felt a slow, rolling anxiety. Beauclair had once, not long ago, told me that he could create hurricanes and tidal waves, that he could drown cities. The Columbia was a mile wide and 60 feet deep. 12. We followed Uncle Mike and Garau through the double doors marked employees only. I'd expected a kitchen, but there was only a stairway that led up or down. We took the up. Uncle Mike shouldn't have had an up. From the outside, it was clearly a single-story building. Apparently that was an illusion, or this was a different kind of stairway. We climbed more than one floor. I started counting on the third floor landing, and I counted 7 more. I don't know that there is a 10-story building in the Tri-Cities. Maybe the new hospital building in Richland. Garau said, opening the door at the top of the stairs,
"We wanted you to have a good view."
It was windy, but warm enough, as we stepped out onto a flat roof, the kind of roof I'd have expected Uncle Mike's to have, with battered machines happily humming away, keeping the tavern a steady temperature, and a knee-high barricade to keep people from walking off the edge. Just the right height for a tripping hazard, I thought. Someone stood on the edge of the roof, looking out over the river. I'd once caught a glimpse of Beauclair without the glamour that made him appear human. It hadn't prepared me for the whole deal. He was, unlike a lot of Fae, almost entirely human-shaped, and his height was somewhere between tall and average, an inch or so taller than Adam, and of a similar build. He turned to greet us, and I could see the hints of the Beauclair I knew, parts that he'd pulled into his glamour, but he didn't look like a human. His cheekbones were high and flat beneath eyes like expensive emeralds, clear and deep. Other than his eyes, his coloring came from the sun. His skin would have been the envy of a California bikini enthusiast. His hair, which reached past his shoulders in a thick, straight fall, held all the colors of gold, with hints of red. Was he beautiful? I couldn't tell. He was extraordinary. "You're just in time," he said. "I have pushed the last of the humans off the bridge, so I am ready for our little demonstration." Garau huffed a laugh, then turned to us. He didn't mean that like it sounded. He encouraged the people who have been working on the bridge to find something else to do. We don't need to kill people for this demonstration. One of our council members was convinced we should flood one of the towns, Burbank or Richland, Uncle Mike said. It took a while to persuade her that killing that many people would ensure that we'd never get a treaty of any kind with you, and it would play right into the hands of our foes on the council. I shivered, though it wasn't cold, and walked as close to the edge as I dared. We had a spectacular view, not as scary as the one from on top of the crane the other day, but spectacular. The Lampson crane was to our left, but it was the view of the Columbia and the cable bridge that was breathtaking in a different way than it had been from on top of the crane. From the crane, it had looked distant and small. From our current vantage point, it felt like we were standing right on top of it, and it was huge. Beauclair raised his hand and said something. It might have been a word, but it sounded bigger than that. It resonated in my chest and in my throat. Below us, under the center of the bridge, the water of the Columbia started to swirl. Magic, thick and rich and warm as the noonday sun in August, pressed down on me, and I went to my knees. Adam put his hand under my elbow, but he had to wrap his arms around me before I could stand. I breathed like a racehorse, and my face grew hot, then very cold, and still the power moved. The swirling water started small, but grew until the whole river circled beneath the bridge, like traffic negotiating the stupid roundabouts that had been showing up where the four-way stop signs used to be. Gradually, the water moved faster, climbing the banks on the outside edge as the center dropped. The pressure of the water made the bridge groan. I could hear it from where we stood. Overhead, a helicopter flew in and hovered. Adam said something that I, consumed by the force of Beauclair's magic, missed, his voice just another rumble in my ears and chest. I heard Garau's reply, though it didn't make much sense to me at the time. "Our helicopter. We called the news agencies about 10 minutes ago, but we wanted to make sure this was recorded for the media. We'll give the footage to the local stations and let them disseminate it. That worked well enough for your killing of the troll." He looked at me. "She is sensitive to magic." Adam grunted rather than answering, and Garau smiled at him. For a moment, he looked less human to me, too, and I had a feeling that the real Garau was a lot bigger than his glamour would suggest. But the bridge groaned again, and all my attention returned to the sight before us. The water on the outside of the whirlpool was level with the bridge deck, much higher than the banks of the river, though Beauclair's magic kept all the water where he wanted it. Beyond the whirlpool, the Columbia's waves grew choppy and white-edged, but the level of the river didn't appear to be affected. The whirlpool quit growing,
but it continued to speed up and drain the middle to feed the edge until I could see bare ground beneath the bridge. The circle grew until the entire section between the two towers was empty of water. The bridge was shaking under the force of the water that now hit the railed edge before rushing over or under the bridge with twisting force. Beauclair spoke another word, and for a moment my eyes wouldn't focus. When I could see again, there was no more dirt beneath the bridge. There was just nothing. A hole so deep that from our perspective I could not see the bottom. The Fae cannot lie. Beauclair had told me he could drown cities, but until this moment I hadn't really understood what that meant, and this was nowhere near the limits of his power. He might have been able to fake his relaxed stance, but I could feel the magic he channeled to the river and the earth, and there was no end to it. It took maybe 3 more minutes, and the bridge gave in to the twisting water, breaking free of its supports and foundations. The noise was tremendous. Uncle Mike shook, and I could hear someone's car alarm go off. For a moment, just after it was ripped from the bank, the bridge held its structure. Then it collapsed, torn apart by the water and by gravity. Some of the bridge dropped into the hole immediately. Some of it was carried by the water to bang back into the supports that had held it up. Battered by water and by debris, the supports for the tower slid into the black hole beneath. The water swirled and spat bits of cement, metal, blacktop, and long, snapping cables into the hole, until the water ran clean and nothing more fell out. Beauclair said another word, a release of some sort, because it was easier for me to breathe again. The hole in the earth closed up, and this time I could watch it happen, the soil building up from the outside and working in until there was nothing but disturbed dirt and rocks where the hole had been. Beauclair said another word, and the water slowed, the whirlpool edge leveled, and the center filled with water. Eventually, the Columbia quit swirling altogether and flowed with deceptive mildness in the same path it had taken an hour ago, except that now it didn't flow past a bridge. It looked beautiful and peaceful. I could see people, some of them in uniform, on both sides of the river, and they were all staring, just like me. Adam turned me around so he could see my face. He wiped my cheeks with his thumbs. That's when I realized there were tears running down my face. I don't know why I'd been crying. I wasn't sad, just overwhelmed by Beauclair's magic. He bent down to me.
"Are you all right?"
His voice slid through the mating bond, caressed me, and cleared my head. I felt like I could take a clean breath for the first time since Beauclair had called his magic. "I'm fine," I told him out loud, because if I spoke through our bond, he would hear too much, and I was afraid that the echoes of magic still rattling my bones might cross and hurt him. I didn't know why it was a worry, just that it was, and I had learned to trust my instincts. He looked at Garau standing patiently beside Beauclair. Sometime while Adam and I were talking, he had regained his usual, unremarkable, glamored appearance.
"You said 2 things, Adam said. "This was the first, a demonstration of what the Fae can do, so that no one thinks you were driven to treat with us because we killed your troll and you're scared. I found your demonstration very convincing."
"The mortals and their government will be very grateful to you for achieving a neutral territory where they can be safe," Garau said. "The second thing is that you need to find a reason for us to treat with you."
"The fire touched would work," Beauclair said. "I would guarantee his safety and his well-being."
"Since he left our care, Underhill has been more difficult," said Garau. "She didn't seem to mind while he was on the reservation grounds. But when he left, she was unhappy."
Beauclair shook his head.
"She didn't care that Newth and Orla tortured him," he clarified. "She only cared when he left her influence. Had I realized that, I would have taken him under my protection in the first place. But it would have cost me political power I needed at the moment to step in to rescue a human, no matter how altered. So..."
He stopped speaking.
"Don't worry," said Garau.
I knew you helped the Darksmith and his son escape with the fire touched. No one had to tell me. Who else would have done it? Don't worry. Most of them are blinded by the fact that the Darksmith killed your father. They wouldn't forgive someone sneezing on them and couldn't comprehend you in a million years, my friend. We won't send the boy back, I said.
Do you doubt me? Asked Beauclair.
He didn't sound offended, but it scared me all the same. It didn't change my opinion, but it did scare me.
No, I said firmly, but he wakes up screaming in terror on the nights he can sleep. He's afraid of you, all of you. If you'd stopped the Widow Queen and her ilk when he first escaped under hell, if anyone had cared for him, he wouldn't have come to us. I don't think that he'll go back willingly, and I think he has suffered enough. I won't encourage him to go back. I trust you and your word, Beauclair, but I don't think that he will survive if he's forced back to you. I won't force him, and I won't allow anyone else to, either.
Beauclair turned to Adam.
Does she speak for you?
She speaks for herself, said Adam. But I agree, he cannot go back.
You will risk the survival of the pack for the happiness of a boy who will not be harmed, said Garau. There was no judgment in his voice. A boy who was not a child at all.
I looked at Adam.
He smiled.
My wolves would not thank me for sending a scared kid to the people in his nightmares just to keep them safe. Safety is not always the key. He belongs to the pack now, and we take care of our own.
And that right there was one of the differences between Adam and Bran. Bran kept his eye on the end game. Adam understood the end game all right, but to him, the people mattered more than the game. The werewolves needed Bran, who could make the tough choices to make sure they survived. I needed Adam, because he would never abandon someone who loved him, the way that Bran had abandoned us, abandoned me, twice. I swallowed and reminded myself I was a grown-up, but I was so grateful that I had Adam.
Name something else, said Adam.
Garau turned to Beauclair and said, I told you that would not happen.
He looked at Adam.
I'm afraid, then, it is up to you.
You can't give us a better clue about what we could offer you,
Adam said.
Ask Z, said Garau. Our people are hungry for magic, and Z has been collecting the weapons he has made.
I raised my eyebrows. Now that makes sense. We find ourselves on opposite sides in a conflict, and to stop it, we give you a powerful magical artifact, a weapon?
Garau grinned at my logic. It might work.
Uncle Mike, who'd been a silent witness to it all, shook his head.
That man has been destroying his toys ever since his wife died. I'm not sure he is anything big enough to matter.
I looked at him, and Uncle Mike shrugged.
He was forced to marry her, and he thought it would be easy, so he allowed it. Then he fell in love for the first time I think. When she died, he was very angry. Angry at the Grey Lords who made him make himself vulnerable. So he started to destroy any of his own work that came back to him. And most of it does, eventually. He also destroys other things when he can, too. The Grey Lords would stop him if they could.
He gave the two Grey Lords present a merry look.
But they can't, so they pretend not to notice.
This is weird, said Jessie at dinner 2 days later. Last week I was a social pariah at school. Hell, her father cleared his throat. Heck, she said, heck. Since the troll died, I could run for class president and win.
Don't fret, Aiden said, eating the spaghetti I'd made as if he was afraid it would run off his plate.
I'm sure you'll be a pariah again soon enough.
That was pretty good, Jessie said, dumping another helping of spaghetti on his plate without his asking. It would have been better, though, if you'd swallowed before you started to talk. We eat with our mouths closed around here.
How do you get the food in? Asked Aiden.
She stopped eating, opened her mouth, then shut it again.
Gotcha,
he said happily, still talking with his mouth full. Adam, I noticed, was looking pretty worn. He hadn't said much since we'd sat down to eat.
Tonight it was just Jesse, Aiden, Adam, and me.
Hoel, who was still experiencing better control of his shape-shifting, had taken his wife out to dinner. No one knew he was a PAC member, so they didn't have to worry about reporters following them around. Adam was taking the brunt of the attention. The local news people knew him, the feds knew him, and a fair number of the national press knew him from previous stories, and he was handsome and articulate, so he was the one they aimed their questions at. How had we known what the Fae were going to do? Why had they done it? Were they planning on doing it again somewhere else? After the first wave of reporters, Adam drafted a statement which he read for the local TV stations.
"It was the Fae," Adam told them. "They came to us and told us that they wanted people to understand what we were dealing with. They are not just the boogie monsters hiding in fairy tales. Some of them are more powerful than that. Some of them were worshipped as gods by our ancestors for very good reasons. The bridge was chosen because it was highly visible, and because it was easy to clear of people, because the Grey Lords don't think that killing people will accomplish what they want, and because it was where we killed the troll. Could they do it to a bridge full of rush-hour traffic in the middle of Seattle, Portland, or Washington, D.C.? Yes. But they could have done that last year, or 10 years ago, too. They don't want to. They and we are trying to negotiate a non-violent end to our situation here in the Tri-Cities, in hopes that it might allow them and us and our government to negotiate a non-violent end to the situation that occurred when our justice system made it clear that justice was for humans only. Thank you.
And when the feds came, Adam told them the same thing, mostly word for word, except where pronouns needed to be clarified. The news people took their photos of my handsome, sincere mate and wrote up what he could give them. But the feds, they were pushier. We had the whole alphabet soup on our doorstep, figuratively speaking, because terrorist attacks belong to the FBI and paranormal anything belongs to Cantrip. But the NSA was here, too. Adam told me that two of the people claiming to be Cantrip and one who was supposed to be FEMA were actually CIA. He told me he could tell by the way they made the back of his neck itch. He recognized it from Vietnam, where he'd first encountered their kind. The feds threatened, cajoled, and stopped just short of arresting Adam. We kept a patrol of werewolves who watched out for the Fae. As a side benefit, the wolves kept the feds off, too. When the director of Cantrip called to complain about our lack of cooperation, Adam told him exactly where he could shove it. And how far? Adam used some of Ben's favorite phrases to remind them that a rogue Cantrip agent and his rogue agent pals had killed one of our own not 6 months ago, that we'd found illegal tracking equipment on our personal vehicle that Cantrip had admitted to placing when they'd summoned Adam to a closed-door meeting while I was talking Sherwood down from the crane. Cantrip would rot before we ever cooperated with them. And he hung up while the director was still talking. 5 minutes later, the FBI called and asked us to cooperate with Cantrip's investigation. Adam said, "No." When the man kept talking at him, Adam threw the phone through the wall. "My husband has a temper. Especially he has a temper when dealing with stupid people. It was why Bran had tried very hard not to use him as a spokesperson. There were no cameras on him when the phone landed in the entryway, so it didn't matter as far as Adam's public face. Our favorite contractor was still working on the damage the fight with the Fae had done to the house. One more wall wasn't going to add that much to the overall bill, so the hole in the wall that the phone made wasn't important either. Two more walls, because Aiden had burned down the wall between the safe room and the adjoining bathroom. The phone survived. That protective case proved that it had been worth the money. The real reason for Adam's short temper was frustration. We still hadn't been able to come up with anything the Fae would want or need, other than Aiden. Despite Uncle Mike's words, I'd have asked C, but he and Tad had left the house the morning after the Fae attack, and I hadn't seen them since. Z's house was empty. There was no sign that he'd been back there since he'd escaped the reservation. In the meantime, life went on.
Adam got his work done mostly from home to avoid the rush of reporters and the feds of whatever alphabet variety. Ben and Warren took turns escorting Jesse to and from school, and we ate breakfast and dinner together. Tonight, it had been spaghetti that I'd made from scratch. The noodles were packaged, though. If Christy had made dinner, the noodles would have been freshly made from scratch, too. I hoped she had met the nice young billionaire of her dreams and decided to stay in the Bahamas. Heck, I even hoped she lived happily for the rest of her life, as long as she did it in the Bahamas. The phone rang while Adam and I were cleaning up the dishes. He started the dishwasher while I answered the phone. He had gotten less and less polite since the sinking of the cable bridge, so I had started answering the phones first when I could. "Houtmans," I said, "what can I do for you?"
"Mercy," said Baba Yaga's voice. "That is not a question you should ask until you know who you're talking to."
Adam spun to look at me, and his response stopped Jesse and Aiden in their tracks. I raised an eyebrow, and he made a rolling motion with his hand. I was, it seemed, to carry on with the conversation. "Just because I asked what I could do doesn't imply I would do it," I said peaceably. "Hello, Baba Yaga. What can I do for you?"
"Well, you could have called me," she said. "Here I all but gave you an engraved invitation." "No, no. I did give you an engraved invitation, didn't I? I gave you my card and told you to call me when you needed information, and yet here I sit, uncalled."
The kids couldn't hear what she was saying, but Adam could. He nodded at me. "Okay, then," I said, and asked her the question we hadn't been able to find an answer to. "What can we do for the Fae that will allow the Grey Lords to sign a treaty with our pack that sets up the Tri-Cities as neutral territory?"
"You could give them the fire-touched boy," said Baba Yaga brightly. "I am sure that Beauclair gave you his word that the boy would be safe. Beauclair would die before breaking that word."
She placed a slight emphasis on her last sentence. She thought that if we sent Aiden into Beauclair's hands, he would die keeping Aiden safe. Not that he would die before letting anything happen to him, but that he would die. Or she wanted me to think that. I pinched the bridge of my nose. "I think we can agree that we don't want Beauclair dead," I said.
"Oh, I think we can indeed agree to that," she replied.
"So we won't give Aiden back to the Fae," I said. "Since we didn't intend to do so, we're doubly convinced that would be the wrong thing to do. What do you suggest?"
"You could steal the sword of Zeebolt Adelbertsmiter," she said. "The blade that cuts through anything and takes any shape it desires. The one he used a few days ago to kill his fellow Fae. I assure you that the Fae would consider that a gift worth signing a treaty that benefits them far more than it benefits you."
"No," I said, "no. I couldn't steal the sword or any other artifact from Z. It would not be possible. Besides, he's off somewhere. I will ask him if he has something the Fae would consider worth signing the treaty for, but as Uncle Mike said, I do know he's been destroying anything he thought too dangerous. Anything he doesn't think too dangerous, the Fae probably wouldn't want."
"True," said Baba Yaga, "true."
She made a humming sound. Then, in an apparently complete change of subject, she said, "Orla is missing." I started to ask her what that had to do with anything. But then I remembered that Orla was the Grey Lord who had tortured Z. Maybe it wasn't a change of subject. So I held my tongue. Aiden was staring at me, his expression frozen. I looked at Adam and tilted my head. He saw Aiden's face and went over to him, putting a hand on his shoulder.
"We won't send you back," he told Aiden.
"I thought we'd already agreed upon that," said Baba Yaga, though she couldn't have seen who Adam had been talking to.
Probably it was only a good guess.
"What is it that the Fae need?" she asked. "I always look at that first when I'm bringing someone a present. What do they need?"
I blinked at the phone, then I looked at Adam, who shrugged. "They need Underhill to play nice," I ventured.
Yes, Baba Yaga agreed. We're not going to give them... Oh, let me rephrase that. You aren't going to give us Aiden. That's right. But you might listen to what he's going to tell you. I'll give you a call back in 5 minutes or so, and you can let me know if he says anything interesting. Ta.
She hung up before I could respond. Aiden and Jesse had been clearing the table. Aiden still had the plastic-wrapped salad in his hands. He seemed to become aware of it after I put the handset back in its stand. He moved away from Adam and put the salad in the fridge.
I will go back, he said, turning to face us.
He looked at Jesse for a moment.
She should be safe, and while I am here, she will never be safe.
And moments like that were why, even though sometimes he was very difficult, I still liked him.
You're not going back, said Adam. And are you implying I can't keep my daughter safe?
Or she can't keep herself safe, Jesse said.
She looked at me.
I forgot to thank you for teaching me how to shoot your rifle.
No trouble, I said. I enjoyed the company. Aiden tilted his head, then shook it.
You can't stop me.
Maybe I could, said Adam, but I won't. I misspoke earlier. You can't go back and be our tribute for the Fae so that they will sign a pact with us. You can go back, but we will tell them that you did it without our knowledge or consent, and so they owe us nothing.
I fought it for a second, but then I kissed Adam, the kind of kiss that made Jesse say,
Really, Mercy? Dad, get a room.
I stepped back and met Adam's eyes. You know I love you, right? I looked at Aiden. So your sacrifice is refused. Baba Yaga seems to think you are the key, though she made it clear that returning you to the Fae would be a bad idea. You are outvoted and outnumbered. Help us think outside of the box. Jesse said,
She told you not to return Aiden to the Fae?
Good. Artifacts might work, but Z isn't here, and he's the only one who would have an artifact that would be powerful enough to make them accept. She held up a hand to me.
The walking stick won't work because it won't stay with them. Giving them something that will only take itself away again will force them to abandon any pact they make.
Right, I said.
Back to Baba Yaga, she said.
Her father watched her with a smile on his face.
She said something about Underhill.
Not quite, I told her. She asked me what the Fae needed, and I told her that they needed Underhill to behave. Aiden sat down on a chair.
Underhill contains a lot of artifacts, he said. I know where some of them are.
You can't go back there, Adam said.
Aiden nodded.
Yes, yes I can. I can get out, too, the same way I got in. I know how to open the doors to Underhill whether she wants me to do so or not. Water figured it out, and she taught all of us.
One of the other elemental changelings? Asked Jesse. I was still stuck on the I know where some of them are part of what Aiden had said. Aiden answered Jesse's question.
There were only 4 of us who survived, sort of survived anyway. I guess I'm the only one who got out and survived the Fae afterward.
Jesse said,
Good for you. So if Dad can get the Fae to guarantee you safe passage to and from Underhill, you can go in and get an artifact that is powerful enough to please the Fae? Something that will let them interact with Underhill better?
He stood up and took Jesse's hand and kissed it.
Yes, my lady, that is exactly what I have to say.
The phone rang. Houtman's mortuary, I answered. You stab him, we slab him. Baba Yaga was wearing off on me.
Hard-boiled is the best way to eat eggs, said Baba Yaga. But I've quit eating eggs. It upset my household. What did the boy who isn't a boy have to say?
I decided I didn't want to know what inspired the information about eggs. He said that if the Fae will guarantee safe from them passage, he knows of an artifact that will help the Fae deal with Underhill.
Very good, she said in a chipper voice that was more usual in bad children's programming on TV. So you and yours have safe passage to Underhill and back from Underhill. We will sign the treaty before you go in, just in case you don't come out again. That way, no one's sacrifice is in vain. No, I'm not listening in, Mercy. That would be rude.
She rolled her R on rude.
People are just so predictable. You should bring your walking stick, Mercy. Oh, and that oh-so-handsome Russian-blooded wolf. Just you four should be enough.
Four? Asked Adam.
You, Mercy, Aiden, and the walking stick, she said. That should be enough. The right ingredients make the stew, you know.
She hung up. I just replaced the handset when it rang again. Yes, I said.
I'm waiting for more cleverness, Baba Yaga said. Hauptmann House of Horrors. Don't mind the screaming, we don't. Something of the sort.
Okay, I said. Hauptmann House of Horrors, she said.
You and that coyote are always ruining my fun. Anyway, I forgot to tell you. We accept your bargain. You should come tomorrow early.
Come where? I asked.
She laughed. To the reservation. Guides will meet you along the way so you won't get caught up in the protections. I don't think I'll see you there, but I'll see you sometime. Ta, darling. Give that wolf of yours a nudge for me. I do love Russian men.
She hung up, and I set the phone back on the counter and watched it. While I waited for her to call again, Adam told Jesse and Aiden what Baba Yaga had said. Jesse frowned at him when he was done. Okay, you, I understand. You can keep everyone safe. Aiden has to go in. But why Mercy? Why not Z, who is Fae, or Tad, who is nearly Fae, or another werewolf?
The walking stick, said Adam after a moment. It only follows Mercy.
I nodded thoughtfully. One of the things it can do is show us the way home. That might be useful in Underhill. Every boarding party needs its guide to light the way, its wizard to defeat the magic, and a tank to kill everything that tries to stop the party, Jesse said.
She had been playing too much ISTDPBF with the pack lately, and it was affecting her thinking.
She looked at her father. The tank is not sacrificial.
Aye, aye, Captain, said Adam, with only a little irony in his voice.
You come home, Daddy, she told him. I love my mother, but if I have to live with her for very long, one of us will commit a homicide. And you bring Mercy and the Pipsqueak back.
Am I the wizard or the guide? I asked our captain.
Aiden is fire-touched, she told me after considering the matter. You can only turn into a coyote. So he's the wizard, even though he has to guide the party in. You guide the party out, and Dad makes sure you all get out alive.
Next time, said Aiden, who'd been learning the fine art of playing pirate on computers, too, I want to be the tank.
Jesse came with us.
No one will touch her, Z told Adam,
breaking into the middle of the heated after-breakfast discussion.
I will be there. Tad will be there. Nothing will happen to her.
Z and Tad had shown up in the middle of the night, neither of them willing to talk about what they'd been doing. Since Baba Yaga had sort of told me already, I didn't ask. I didn't want to know.
What do you mean you'll be there? Asked Adam. Underhill doesn't like our kind, Z said, so we won't follow you in. But Tad and I will come with you. We will watch over Jessie and see that nothing befalls her. I agree that Underhill is no place for someone who is wholly human.
He glanced at Aiden, who grimaced and nodded emphatically.
But Jessie is no longer a child. It is her right to witness what her father does.
The Alpha Wolf and the Dark Smith held each other's eyes. Daddy? Asked Jessie. The Alpha stare-down broke up with neither participant a winner or loser. Please, she said.
Fine, Adam huffed,
because Jessie's awesome, seldom-used secret power was that she had her father wrapped around her little finger. Now that that's settled, I said, we should go. I took my dishes to the sink and stopped to kiss Adam's cheek as I passed him. I would have moved on,
but he held me against him for a moment. He smelled of me, of our early morning lovemaking, and of the pack. But mostly he smelled like himself, mint and musk and Adam. We loaded ourselves into Adam's SUV. I took the middle of the front while Jesse took shotgun, leaving Aiden, Z, and Tad to sort themselves out in the back seat. As Adam backed the SUV out of its parking space, I saw Howell in human form leaning against the frame of the front door. He wasn't happy at being left behind, but that was an argument Adam had won. Ben, who had listened in, had quipped lightly, "You know you've got a good alpha when everyone beats each other up trying to throw themselves into the tar pit after he jumps in." But he'd patted Howell on the shoulder and said, "Enough. We all know you're willing, and if you weren't, there are a dozen of us who would have his back if he needed it. He appreciates it, but you're distracting him from what he needs to do." And so Howell had given in. He watched us drive off with an unhappy expression on his face. But he would wait. He was pack. He knew he was valued, that he had purpose. That didn't mean he had to be happy about obeying orders, just that he obeyed, which is why he mostly fit in the pack a lot better than I did. Suggestions I might follow. I had trouble with orders. It was still dark out as we pulled into the road. Adam's shoulder against mine was warm. For an accidental moment, I caught his thoughts. It was just a visual of my face, lit by the blue light of the dash. It wasn't the face I saw in the mirror every day. He thought I was beautiful. He was worried for me. I saw his hands tighten on the wheel and put my hand on his thigh. I don't think he knew I'd caught what he was thinking. I was lucky he wasn't thinking I should lose a few pounds or clean under my nails better, or how gorgeous that early morning jogger we just passed was, and she was. "Adam?" I asked. He didn't answer, still lost in his thoughts. "Hey, Adam," I said again.
"Wool gathering," he told me with a faint smile.
I grinned at him. "An appropriate activity for a wolf."
"Did you need something?"
he asked. "For this trip to be done, for all of us to be home and safe." "No," I said lightly, for if I did, I've forgotten what it was. Silence fell in the SUV again. It was early. I wiggled to get comfortable. The center seat was more suited to a child than an adult. From the back seat, the scent of fear was getting stronger. To distract him, because it wasn't Z or Tad who was worried, I asked, "So, Aiden, what do you think we'll find in Underhill?"
"Underhill," said Aiden stoically.
He was afraid, but he also smelled resigned, like the rabbit who knew it was dead and quit struggling. The confidence he'd shown us last night was gone. He cleared his throat and said,
"Sometimes the terrain is forest or desert. Sometimes it's a snowy mountaintop or an ocean so deep you can't find the bottom. If you blink, it can change, but it doesn't matter where you are. Underhill is always there." His voice tightened. "Watching."
"What do you think will happen?" asked Jesse.
After a moment, Aiden said,
"She'll pretend to ignore us at first, I think. She'll be mad at me, and she'll want to take her time to decide what to do."
"Why mad?" asked Jesse.
Since Aiden was telling her more than he told Adam or me, I thought I'd just keep quiet and see what Jesse could pull out of him.
"Because I left," he said. "None of us was supposed to leave her, and I was the last one. Water, earth, air, fire. Her creations, she called us, her children. The others died or were killed when they left her. She told me about it."
He hesitated.
"I think she caused their deaths, or did something that made the Fae cause their deaths. I left last because I was afraid to leave."
"So why are you going back?"
Jesse's voice was cool.
"If she caused their deaths, don't you think she'll kill you?"
"No," he said, when I could tell he hadn't intended to say anything at all on the subject.
"Not while I'm in Underhill itself, because that would be cheating. If we get attacked and I can't defend myself, That's a fair death. But she can't turn her hand specifically toward that end, or she'll ruin her own game.
When Adam turned off the highway and took the road that used to lead to the reservation, dawn was lightening the sky, though the sun herself wouldn't be up for 15 or 20 minutes. He drove steadily past vineyards and cornfields into the hill country. I was pretty sure that he'd driven farther than it had taken to get to the reservation, but it didn't seem to bother him. The road took a sharp turn I didn't remember. Then Adam had to hit the brakes hard so he didn't run into the horsemen lined up across the road. There were three of them, each riding a white horse and dressed in gray. As soon as the SUV stopped completely, they turned their horses and began trotting down the road.
"Our guides?" Adam asked the backseat denizens.
"Yeah," said Z. "Good to know that drama is still alive and well among the Fae. Schimmelreiter. Bah, theatrics."
Adam was smiling his hunting smile as we followed the three galloping horses, who moved as fast as the SUV could safely negotiate the narrow mountain road that bore no resemblance to the road that used to go to the Ronald Wilson Reagan Fae Reservation. The road might go different paths, but the walls around the reservation had been left, block cement topped by stainless steel razor wire. The guard towers were apparently empty, and the gates hung wide open. It looked abandoned, but it didn't smell that way. It smelled green and alive, even through the filter of the SUV. The horses slowed to a walk to cross through the threshold of fairyland, and Adam slowed the SUV to follow them. Z made no sound as they crossed into the reservation, but I could smell Tad's sweat. Aiden's heart beat double time. Jesse and Adam were the only ones in the car who weren't affected. I include myself as the affected. The one time before that I'd been in Underhill had been a scary, scary thing. We followed the walking horses through streets that could have been in any unimaginatively laid-out suburb in America as the sun rose and lit the world. The streets were set in a numbered grid, as if the original architect feared that people might get lost here. I knew how they felt, but I also thought that the hope that a sign could lead someone out of Fairy was the belief of an innocent. Magic was stronger here than it had been the last time I'd come. I gripped Adam's thigh and practiced a swimmer's breathing, in through my mouth and out through my nose, in an effort to block the overwhelming rush. It wasn't as bad as when Beauclair sank Cable Bridge, but it was bad enough.
"Are we feeling Underhill?"
asked Adam in a low voice. I looked at him. Adam wasn't very sensitive to magic, but his wolf looked out through his eyes, so he was feeling something.
"Yes," said Aiden. His voice was faint. "This is what happens in places where there are too many doors and too small an area. Her magic leaks out."
"Even though the doors have long been closed in the old country," Z added, "there are places that people avoid because the spill of magic lingers, and others that they visit in hopes of miracles."
There were still Fae in Europe, I knew, but most of them had come to the New World fleeing the spread of cold iron. Iron had followed them here too, but they seemed to have come to some sort of terms with it. Tolkien's elves had traveled to the west, and there were scholars who argued that Tolkien had known some of the Fae left behind who spoke with longing of their kinsfolk who had traveled to the New World. The horses stopped in front of what had once been a municipal building of some sort. The sign in front of it was hacked into indecipherable splinters, the bits of wood left where they lay, though the lawns were mowed and tidy. As soon as the riders began to dismount, Adam turned the SUV off and got out. I scooted out behind Jessie because I wanted to make sure she wasn't standing alone in the reservation for long. Of the six of us, she was the most vulnerable, which was why Adam had tried to leave her at home. Standing here among our enemies, or at least our unpredictable and dangerous acquaintances, I wished he'd succeeded. Two of the riders led the horses away, but the other one waited to escort us into the building. Adam went first. Z and Tad took the rear guard, and the rest of us spread out between them. The building wasn't much to look at. Built to the military specs of the 80s, cement steps took them to a plain painted door set into uninspired vinyl siding. But inside... Jessie sucked in her breath and said, "It's a TARDIS."
"A what?" asked Aiden.
"Bigger on the inside than it is on the outside," Jessie said. She was right, because we'd entered not a small antechamber that probably had originally been the first thing visitors saw, but a spacious room with marble floors and pillars. The marble was pink, flecked with patches of black and gray. The room was empty, and our escort didn't slow down as he crossed the room and out through one of many doorways. This one led to a large office, easily large enough it didn't feel crowded despite floor-to-ceiling bookcases and the seven of us. In contrast to the size of the room, Beauclair's desk was of normal size. The Fey Lord himself sat behind it.
"Sir," said our escort, "I bring you the guests you were expecting."
He didn't wait for acknowledgement, just turned and left the room. Beauclair cleared away the papers he was working on and set them in a folder without hurrying. His desk was as hyper-organized as Adam's. Adam had learned to organize in the army. I wondered where Beauclair had picked up the habit. Only when the papers had been properly stowed did he turn his attention to us.
"Gentlemen," said Beauclair, his gaze drifting past Adam's face and lighting on mine briefly before stopping to dwell on Jessie's. "Ladies?"
"My daughter," said Adam, answering the question the Fae wouldn't ask. "She needed to see us off on our journey."
Beauclair knew about daughters. His face lit with appreciation of our predicament.
"I told him no harm would come to her here," said Z.
Beauclair met Z's eyes in a way he hadn't Adam's. "I am pleased to help you keep that vow." Z inclined his head regally.
"You wouldn't happen to know why Orla and several other Fae of her cadre are missing, would you?" Beauclair asked Z.
Z smiled and said nothing. Beauclair smiled back. Evidently none of the missing would be missed by him. Beauclair reached into a desk drawer and brought out a roll of vellum. He stretched it out across the desk so the lettering faced us, putting a paperweight at the top and the bottom to keep it rolled out.
"The others have signed," he told Adam. "When you have read it and signed, I'll make my mark and the bargain will be made."
Adam nodded, pulled up a seat and began to read. I read over his shoulder. "We, the Grey Lords of Faerie, representing themselves and all of Faerie, do make this bargain with Adam Alexander Hauptmann and his mate Mercedes Athena Thompson Hauptmann, who represent themselves and the Columbia Basin Pack." When Adam was finished, he stood up and looked at Z.
"Would you mind going through it as well?"
Z nodded. It didn't take him as long as it had us.
"It says what we think it does," he said, his smile brief but real. "It helps that the Fae want this more than you do."
After Tad nodded too, I wrote my name in the space left for me, then handed Adam the quill pen to sign. Beauclair rounded the desk to sign rather than turn the sheet around. When he was finished, he set the pen aside and put his hand on the vellum. He took three deep breaths, and magic swelled. I sneezed twice and still couldn't get the tickle out of my nose. Beauclair bent his head then and spoke a word. Adam put his hand on my shoulder, but Beauclair didn't use the kind of power he'd called when destroying the bridge. When he took his hand off the document, there were two copies. He rolled them both and wrapped some kind of keeper around the rolls. One of those he left on his desk, and the other he gave to Z.
"I'll take you to a door," he said, and started out of his office, only to pause in the doorway. "You should take off any iron or steel you have on your persons."
But Adam had spent the night going through the go-bags he kept ready and waiting in our closet. He'd substituted plastic and nylon for most of the metal. I had a thought. "Adam, your dog tags, what are they made from?"
"Stainless steel," Adam told me, and started to take his off.
I had one of his tags on the necklace I always wore. I undid the clasp and looked at it. It was an untidy mess,
A gold lamb charm, my wedding ring, and the tag. I put out my hand and took Adam's steel necklace with his remaining tag, and then I put both necklaces around Jesse's neck. "These are our promise to you," I told Jesse, "that we'll do our best to get back to you if we can, that we will do our best and expect the same from you."